Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, I'm Jake Humphrey. Welcome to this week's Premier League Tonight podcast, where I'm joined by Stephen Gerrard, Jermaine Genius and Steve McManaman. This week, we discuss the managers in potential Premier League crisis and the effect of bringing in a new manager to help a struggling side. We'll talk about VAR. Is it really ready for the World Cup? And finally, Jermaine Genius shares his career reflections. We're going to start by talking about Everton and Pete McPartland. Here he is.
Another disgraceful performance. Can't win away from home. Manager can't set them up to defend. Just abysmal. Just abysmal. This Everton team at the moment. I honestly don't think there's a worse team in the Premier League. I think we're just about skating by. I honestly don't think there's a team that plays worse football than Everton. I don't think there's a team with less team spirit than Everton. I don't think there's a team that fights less for the fans. And I don't think there's another team who's got a manager who cares less about the club than we've got. They're simply all the problems we've got at the moment.
Here's a tweet as well from Dominic King. He's a journalist for the Daily Mail. The winter break in Dubai worked well then. Two games, two defeats. Everton at their strongest when team and fans are together. Never seen this relationship so fractured. And he's seen a lot of Everton over the years. Look, it's a team that you grew up watching and loving. And this all comes on the back of a couple of years ago when they were spending money and Everton fans thought this was a bright new future for them. But this is bad.
Yeah, it's really bad at the moment. And, you know, thankfully, listen to that gentleman there talk, who's a diehard Evertonian. There's no bias, you know, Liverpool Everton bias here. They're not making any chances away from home. They're not creating anything. They look as if there's no plan at Everton. I knew there was a plan when Roberto Martinez was there. I knew what type of football they were going to try and play. I know what kind of future they had planned. I know he went through a sticky patch himself, and you know he went and Ronald Koeman came in, but then they seem to have just ripped it up just to stay in the Premier League and completely panicked. The signings have just been a little, what can you say, woeful, let alone strange. And now they look as if they've got no plan at all. I don't know what the plan is for Everton. I don't know whether the manager's going to be involved come August. Mm. I don't know who's going to buy the players. I don't know whether who's in charge, who the new owner is, or whether it's someone in the background. I don't know whether Bill Kenwright is still the figurehead for Everton. But in the last 2 years, they've suddenly acquired these billions of pounds and they've gone way, way, way backwards. And they're lucky that they're still in ninth. How on earth are they in ninth with the form they're playing? But they could easily be eclipsed because the league is so concertina that if they keep on losing games, they'll suddenly be... Swansea were in 18th before, they're now in 13th. They could be on Everton's tails very soon, and these teams are going to be flip-flopping if they don't sort themselves out.
I totally agree with Maka. You know, I think plan is the word. I really do, and you can take that into almost their style of play. You know, we all watch a lot of football in the Premier League, and I reckon I could go through the league and give you an idea of what team, how they're going to set up, and how they're going to play. If you ask me about Everton, I ain't got a clue. I haven't got a clue what their direction is as to how they're going to win a game of football. I don't know, you know, are they trying to get it wide and get the ball into the box? Are they trying to use the men in the hole? Are they trying to kind of play long? I actually don't know what Everton's style of play is, because when I watch them, I never see it. And I've watched a lot of Everton this year, especially in the Europa League, where they were absolutely shocking. So it's frustrating times, obviously, for Evertonians and their fans, especially when they've spent so much money.
Proper money. Did they just panic with disappointment at Sam Allardyce, do you think? They saw where they were in the league, and at that time they were close to the bottom three.
Yeah, I think they had to panic. And they had to make the decision to get Big Sam. And when he come in, he had an impact. And that impact will be enough to keep them in the league. But long term, is Sam Allardyce the answer? I don't think he is, because I don't think his style is Everton's style or what Everton's style should be. They've got a tremendous following, and they're a footballing team. And Big Sam is not that type of manager. I think the court in between philosophies, and I think the plan, they did have a plan, but because of that panic, they've completely gone to a new philosophy in Big Sam. So they're sort of caught. They don't know what they are. They've got a load of Koeman's players, a load of Roberto Martinez's players, and a load of Steve Walsh's players who've come in for a football philosophy. But all of a sudden, they've ripped it up, scrunched it up, and they've gone for someone who's more direct, who's a motivator. And at the moment, after that impact, he doesn't seem to be able to motivate them anymore.
Lots of Everton fans on social media. Here's a question actually from Paul Cunningham. He said, Allardyce, Moyes and Pardew showing the merry-go-round of old managers has to stop. It's time to bring in new ideas and fresh perspectives. And this is interesting because you've got Allardyce, Pardew and Moyes going into clubs and struggling. And at the same time, you've got the likes of Carvalhal going into Swansea. You've got Gracia going in and making a change at Watford. Claude Puel.
Everton have tried that though, Jake, no? With Martinez and Koeman. Yeah. Aren't they the new ideas, the foreigner with the new ideas and the plan and the philosophy?
So shouldn't
Everton have stuck with one of them and sort of
saw through the bad times?
Would they be any worse off if Koeman was in charge now?
I don't think so.
So should they have stuck with Ronald Koeman? Was that the answer?
Well, you could go back to Roberto Martinez. Should they have stuck with him? But it got the vitriol towards Roberto Martinez at the end of his tenure was really bad, and they had to change him before the last game of the season. He never turned up at the last game of the season. It was that bad. So you can see why they have changed the managers. But there has to be a plan of, right, how we're going to move forward. You can't just panic and say, right, whenever Sam took over in October, November, when it was, we need to stay in the Premier League, it's too much money, we'll change the manager again at the end of the season and start all over again. That just cannot happen. You have to be braver than that. And I get the managers, the talk of managers, but then, you know, the three managers you mentioned, they're all foreign managers coming in. So, you know, they tried David Unsworth and they were not particularly happy with him at the time, so they've changed him. And it's trying to find that right man, isn't it? The right time.
OK, well, let's hear from Sam Allardyce, Alan Pardew and David Moyes, and then we'll talk about the future for managers in the Premier League in a moment. But first, have a quick listen to this.
We've only got ourselves to blame. And again, it's another away defeat we could certainly today could have avoided. And had we done better in the first half in front of goal, would have won it, I believe.
People will turn these situations and the media turn it into a personal situation with myself. But it's about West Brom, it's not about me. And, if the consequences are that I lose my job, then that will be what it is. All I can hope is that, and what I think was on their surface today, was a commitment from the players to try and address the situation. We know it's very, very tough.
It was the worst performance since I've been at West Ham. And we just never really at any time looked as if we were that in control. I can only say to the supporters, I'm going to do everything to make sure that we're ready for the next game and hopefully they're behind us when we get to the London Stadium next week.
Well, he looks a broken man. Sam Allardyce doesn't look happy. Everton are just outside the bottom half of the table. They're sitting 10th. You can see there West Ham struggling now in 14th. Absolutely not safe at all yet. And West Brom bottom of the table in 20th. What do you think then about whether it's the same old faces are still doing a job? Because there was a time where there was a school of thought that if you were a team in trouble, you went with the good old traditional manager who had experience of the Premier League and they would do the job for you. But Carlos Carvalhal didn't have any experience of the Premier League. Javi Gracia went into Watford with no experience of the Premier League and they're picking up results.
Look, they are. I suppose there is that kind of worry that there is this new niche in the market for a certain type of manager with experience to kind of sit tight until, I don't know, January time or just before when clubs start to panic and think, well, I'm going to get this job and I'm going to take it forward. But there being that disconnect almost between fans, which is where the problem, I think, starts to be created. I think if you look at Sam Allardyce, you would argue he actually had that impact. Mm. And he took away that panic that was there. So that's job done. But then long term, you've got a problem. And it could have happened with Alan Pardew. They could have had that kick that everyone seems to get, but was he going to be the man long term? They haven't had that. So immediately people point the finger and go, well, you know, our managers getting lazier, and are the foreign managers now the coaches that are the ones to go to? It's a tricky one, I have to say, because we've got a couple now that have not done so well, and we haven't got that bump from. So the accusations will always be thrown at them.
And I think these managers will end up getting the blame because they'll probably end up losing their jobs. But what about the people who've made the signings before them, like directors of football and people who've made the decisions before they come in? Yeah, they'll get the blame, as they do, like managers always do. But I think it's very harsh and unfair of us to sit here and say that Allardyce and Moyes and Pardew are bad managers. They've inherited bad teams that are littered with bad players who are not good enough.
And what I also would say on the back of that is that we know that Carlos Carvajal's had some sort of impact at Swansea, but he won a few games and he did well in the FA Cup. Before today's game, he was in the relegation zone again. He was 18th. So it's can he go again? And he did. They won again today and they've gone to 13th. But that could easily change round again. It's fine. They are getting a bump at the moment. And Grathia beat West Brom, so they've jumped up the table a couple of spots. But they have to continue this. We might be having a conversation in a month's time where Javi Grathia has flip-flopped with David Moyes and Carvajal's gone the other way. They need to keep on going. Yes, they've done well and they have had a lift. But, as Jermaine rightly said, Sam Allardyce did that initially. Mm. Moise did that initially. Roy Hodgson did that initially. But they've come back again.
It's also indicative of the fact that the jobs that the sort of traditional English managers are getting are the jobs where teams are in a load of trouble and all they want is a short-term fix. Like what we talk about, the manager bounce, don't we? Yeah. That sort of three or four games, just hoping enough to save us. And that's what some of these managers have been reduced to.
There's 10 awful teams at the bottom of that league and they could all change in the next three or four weeks when they play each other. Looking at the fixtures today, they were quite uninspiring fixtures, but they were incredibly important. Yeah. Swansea-West Ham, what a game. Yeah. Watford against West Brom, what a game. You know, these fixtures were incredible fixtures today. But each team is just doing that every single week and we keep blaming another manager every week as well.
What is it about this new manager bounce? I saw a quote from Jack Butland this week and he basically came out and said, too much in the first part of the season, we hadn't hit the heights in terms of running stats, winning tackles and 50-50 battles. The manager has come in with zero tolerance, no-nonsense kind of attitude. In some ways, and I know what Paul Lambert's like as a manager and he is like that, but that kind of angers me as a football fan because I don't care who your manager is.
If you're playing for my club,
I want your running stats and your tackle wins and your battles to be won. Why do you need a new manager to come in to create that in the Stoke dressing room?
Well, I don't think you do. If you're down where you are and you did well last year, you're the one to blame. You and your teammates are the one to blame. I know the manager goes out and sets you up, but you work hard all week on the training ground, I presume, with all these managers. He sends you out in a certain shape and then it's 11 men against 11 men that you've faced many times before. You have to outrun, outfight whoever's marking you and make it a personal battle. And if 8 of your teammates do the same, you'll win the game.
What have you guys experienced of this kind of manager bounce in your careers when there's been a change in the dressing room?
The closest I came to it was when we, I think we were third bottom of the league with Spurs when we were with Wande Ramos. Yeah. But in fairness, Jake, that year we sold Berbatov to Man United, we sold Robbie Keane to you lot at Liverpool, and we sold Jermaine Defoe to Portsmouth.
Yeah.
So we sold 60 goals about, and we were good keeping the ball. We get to the top end of the pitch, we signed Pavlyuchenko, Darren Bent and Fraser Campbell from United. We just couldn't put the ball in the back of the net. It wasn't going well. Anyway, so we bring Harry in. First couple of games goes well. We had the 4-4, obviously, at Arsenal. We get massive confidence from that. Yeah. But the first three things that he did in January is he brought Peter Crouch back in, Jermaine Defoe, and Robbie Keane came back. And we ended up finishing, I think, 5th that year. So, we got that initial kick. But, I think that was a lot to do with the understanding of what we needed. And I think when, talk about running and winning 50-50s, that's down to the players. That's just ridiculous. Mm. When you talk about direction and maybe a way to play and a structure, and a manager can bring that to the table, that will give you a lift and maybe a confidence and a way of playing. We see it last year with Paul Clement, and we've seen it now with obviously a couple of new managers, especially at Swansea.
I think the one I can remember is Kenny taking over from Roy here. I think Roy Hodgson's final days and weeks here were very tough for him personally, but you could feel it as a player.
Yeah.
The tension in the crowd, you know, they were singing Kenny's name every 5-10 minutes. And I think before Roy was announced to be the manager, I think the majority of the fans wanted Kenny in anyway. So yeah, the final days of Roy's were tough, and then when Kenny came, the atmosphere changed in the ground and in the club, and you know, the players sort of got a lift from that, because it was uncomfortable playing in the atmosphere under Roy. It felt tense, and I think the players, you could feel them going into a shell. But when Kenny came, it just seemed to lift, and you got that manager.
So as players, did you give more under Kenny Dalglish?
I didn't, because you know, I don't play.
General,
but I don't play for a manager.
For the manager, yeah.
I turn up to work on a Monday myself, and I have values and principles in myself that I give every single day, and then I take the Monday to Friday into the game. So if Liverpool didn't have a manager, I would still give exactly the same effort and commitment and desire for the badge
don't
and for the fans.
Have that same approach?
Do you want me to phone them all and ask them?
No.
But they should
your
do.
Memory, though.
If you're a winner, you should do. And him, as the captain of this team, would see at the training grounds, and if people were walking around and not giving a monkeys, he'd be on at them. Oi.
The fans as well. Fans would be
going
on
mad.
Them.
So you're not allowed to. Otherwise, you don't play on a Saturday. If you don't give a... If you don't care in training and you think you can just walk around and mess around, then go away. Because you're affecting him and him and him. You can't carry anybody out on the field on a Saturday, so you might as well not be there.
Were there any situations, though, Stevie, where when Roy was manager and you said yourself it felt tense, that there were players that were targeted by the fans that would then have a negative effect
on
the way that you
played? No, I think Roy took the blame. I think the manager weren't happy with some of his signings. But you know yourself, when you're playing and the crowd are tense and they get on the players and the team's back, you know yourself, you maybe don't try something or you sort of go safe. And that's me talking as an experienced player, as the captain. So it probably had a bigger impact on all
also,
the other players.
Also, some players get more affected by the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Especially
lesser players, less experienced, young players.
Yeah.
If they give a ball away and the crowd go, oh, the next time, as Stephen rightly said, they're not going to try a nice pass down the line. They're just going to go centre half.
Correct.
And every time they get it, simple pass.
That'll be happening now at Everton, at
West Brom,
at Stoke.
Yeah.
People will be playing within themselves because confidence will be low. The fans will be on them, it'll be tense, and then that affects individual and team play.
And when that happens, are you out there as a footballer thinking, why are you doing this? Like, if you're not happy with the manager, fine, but you're affecting the players, this isn't productive.
No, but that has always happened. You have to fight through it, you have to get through it, you have to play hard, you have to win a game, you have to get everybody behind you. How many times have you heard that, oh, we're probably better playing away from home because there's less of your fans there, they'll get out-shouted, so you feel a little bit more confident, but you have to get through that. How are you ever going to succeed if you can't take a little bit of criticism off somebody and get on and move forward?
Okay. And finally, maybe it tells us something as well, doesn't it, about what life was like under Mark Hughes at Stoke, if a player is coming out and saying, oh, we're trying harder, we're winning tackles, we're running a bit more.
I think that's harsh.
If you're Mark Hughes,
if you look at some of the things that Mark Hughes... I think Mark Hughes took Stoke to their highest ever finish within the Premier League as well. Most of their finishers were in the top half. Granted, this year, you know, it seemed to all fall apart for Mark Hughes and Stoke. Yeah. But I think just to kind of to throw that accusation at Mark Hughes, you'd be raging.
Yeah. After finishing,
what he's
after
done
finishing
that,
ninth in the league, you can't say that.
You'd be angry reading that, do you?
Yeah, I think it's a poor quote.
Yeah.
Because I think under Mark Hughes, the Stoke players were trying and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I don't think they weren't running around and they weren't tackling. For me, I think it's a poor quote.
Yeah, I watched Stoke a lot of times last year. I think they finished ninth. Forgive me if I'm wrong.
I think they did.
And they played teams, Arsenals and things. And every time I seen them, every time I went to Stoke and watched them, I thought they gave their all. I really did.
Yeah.
Win, lose or draw. I thought, you know what? They've tried hard. They've worked hard. And when I look at the likes of, I don't know, Shaw, Crosses and people like that who've been there for a few years, don't tell me they don't try. Don't tell me they don't give everything for every single game.
Yeah.
They might go through bad patches with injuries and stuff, but you can't level a lot of that on a lot of the players.
It's worth pointing this out, actually. We've got the stats here, I believe, that we can compare them. Look at this. So this is under Mark Hughes and under Paul Lambert this season. This is per game. And as you can say, they're covered a little bit further under Mark Hughes.
There you go. Support,
so actually, there isn't much in it. But maybe, you know, to give Jack Butland a bit of credit, or to be fair to him. Maybe he's just trying to say positive stuff about life
maybe,
on the Paul
maybe,
Lambert.
Maybe, that's fine.
Maybe it also just feels better for whatever reason, you know?
But he's got to think before he says stuff like that and have some respect for the previous staff that have gone out. If he's got the stats to back it up, what he's saying, and it's right, then yeah, say it. But I think he's said something that's got no substance.
Lots of comments coming in from Everton fans about Sam Allardyce. I'll just run through a few of them for you. Duncan UK 45, how about Everton getting Rafa as their next manager after Sam? I appreciate the link to the Reds. Might not be welcome by fans, but he still lives in the area. Proven success. And as Stevie says, a Premier League manager could do a lot worse. What do you think?
He'd be good for them.
Yeah.
Would I like to see it? No.
Yeah.
Because I think if you've saved Liverpool as Rafa has, I don't think you should go and cross the park and work for Everton and vice versa. But if it happens, he'll definitely be a good appointment. And
would they be good for him?
Well, why not? Because they're in a better position.
You make them better.
As a club, they're in a better position as Newcastle. You know, they're steady at the top. They're spending money, and that's what Rafa's complaining that Newcastle are not doing now. So.
Okay, right. Well, thanks for your comments in that first part. We're now going to talk VAR. I know you've got opinions on that as well, so get those coming into us as well using the hashtag PL tonight. Right, let's just confirm what has actually happened today, just so it's crystal clear for you, if you take a look at this. So today, there was a vote, and the International Football Association Board unanimously approved the adoption of VAR on a permanent basis. So the decision on VAR use at the World Cup is just expected to be rubber stamped by FIFA on March the 16th, but everyone's expecting that to happen. And FIFA are also developing an information system for stadium screens at the World Cup. When a review is live, why the review is happening and what the outcome is, which is key. The Premier League vote is expected later in the season. Just to give you the heads up for that, the vote is in April. 14 of the 20 clubs in the Premier League have to vote to have VAR as something that's a regular thing in the Premier League next season. We already know, though, that it's not going to be regular in the Champions League. Yep. Joining the conversation, Chris Foy. Welcome along, Chris. First of all, your reaction to this. There was a bit of surprise from people. Is it the right time, and is VAR ready for the World Cup stage?
Well, I'm like you. I was a little surprised today when it was announced. However, they've decided in the wisdom, the international board, that they want to implement it. I think they're talking about they've done 4,000 games around the world and tried and tested it. So they feel it's ready. As you say, they haven't rubber stamped it yet. That's the 16th of March.
Do you feel it's ready, Chris?
I'm not sure yet. I'm seeing things that are really good. I'm seeing things where we can improve. I mean, a great example today in the game we've just watched with Salah and Jamal Lasalle. I think at the end we've got a misread card and a free kick outside the box. I think that's where VAR could have got involved. And the flip side of the coin is if you look at the Tottenham Rochdale game on Wednesday, that was the other side of it where it was a bit disappointing with the outcome for a goal that was chalked off.
Chris and Stevie Mack, who will be the referees who decide who sit in this box? Will it be from all over the world, or will it just be one particular referee chosen by FIFA?
What happens, Steve, you're quite right. It's world football, but they've been using VAR in a number of countries. Bundesliga, obviously, Italy, we've got it in the MLS, they're using it in Australia. And what they've done in the past in the World Cup is they've used referees and they've had dedicated fourth officials and obviously assistant referees. So I'm presuming that they will have a number of people who will act as VARs and VARs only.
So you could have a situation where you've got a refereeing team who are using it at the World Cup, having never used it before competitively. They've been trained on it, they know how it works, but they've not been in a competitive match situation. That could happen.
Well, they have a training hub, I'm led to believe, in FIFA, but I would imagine the training they're going to undertake will be really strong, and I would imagine they'll probably use referees from countries that have used it, because in England at the moment, I think we've only used 4 VARs up to now. So I think there's a lot of planning, there's a lot of preparation, there's a lot of training, there's still a long way to go with it.
We were at Wembley on Wednesday night.
Yeah.
So do you think it's ready for the World Cup?
No, I don't. I don't think it's ready for the Premier League. I don't think it's ready for the World Cup. I think there are aspects of the VAR that, that have potential. I really do. The teething process is taking too long for me. I've not seen that improvement. We keep talking about, it's a work in progress, Well, we've had it all year now, really, within the FA Cup.
I don't think I've even seen a new problem every time.
I think it's
good the fact that FIFA are now going to put it on the big screens and tell the paying public this is what's happening and why. That is a big jump forwards. But actually, the technology itself doesn't seem to be working, does it? So we've only had 10, 15 games.
I think it's the use of the technology, isn't it?
Well, they seem to be stopping it every 5 minutes, don't they? And I think we if there's 4,000 games happening that we haven't got access to and we don't really know the results, we know the Bundesliga is a bit up, hit and miss.
Yeah.
We don't know about the MLS and, you know, the Australian A-League, whatever, but we don't know if they've had huge success over there. But what we've seen in the Premier League, we don't want it anywhere near our Premier League in the near future, do we?
Or the World Cup. Yeah. I think whilst there's issues and problems, I think they should keep it away from the big stage, and there's nothing bigger than the Premier League and the World Cup. So until it's perfect, keep it away.
I think the Champions League, UEFA, have quickly distanced themselves away from it. They're not going to use it next year. So they're going to have 18 months, aren't they, at least, to see how VAR progresses and if it keeps on improving. So the fact that UEFA have gone, no, thank you, and I presume the Premier League will say, we're not starting again with it in August, maybe the following August, but we're certainly not going to touch it. I think it's far too soon on what we've witnessed at this moment in time in the Premier League.
There's a reason why goal line technology just works so well. It's because it's black and white. Mm. Is the ball over the line or not? And we all go, yeah, brilliant, let's move on. And it's quick. And for me, the reason why VAR doesn't work like that is because I still think there's a lot of subjective issues within it. Exactly like Llorente goal the other day. You know, has he been pulled or has he not been pulled? Mm. We're all going at this moment, well, he's got his hands on Llorente. Llorente's got his hands on him. Where's the problem? Because if you're telling me that when a goal goes in, everything is reviewed and the decision has to be clear and obvious for the goal to be stopped. That was not clear and obvious for me. It might be clear and obvious to one person. It might be clear and obvious to the guy that's actually operating the system. But for maybe 50,000 fans watching on the big screen, they'll be going, "What? I don't get it."
Look, Chris,
that's not clear and obvious.
I know sometimes, Chris, it can be difficult for you because you've got, you know, former colleagues and friends, and you've been involved in elements of developing the VAR system. How bad was Wednesday night for VAR in this country, do you think? Because it felt to us like it was an awful evening for the system from start to finish.
I think the big thing that people talked about was the time. I think where we set the bar on Wednesday night was far too low with clear and obvious, because the Llorente goal wasn't clear and obvious. I think what surprised most people was that the VAR, who was at Stockley Park, didn't say to the referee, have a look at it, you know, I suggest an on-field review. So he goes to the screen and looks at it. I've got to be brutally honest with you, if that had been me refereeing that game, I wouldn't have expected to chalk the goal off, and if it was the VAR, it's exactly the same. But the flip side to the coin was there was a really good decision where an assistant referee gave a free kick outside the box, which was wrong because it was actually turned over and a penalty was given. So you're seeing a full sliding scale of good stuff and stuff where they can improve. But the big thing on Wednesday night I found was people in freezing cold temperatures were waiting around and stuff was taking 2 minutes, and time is of the essence, and the fan experience is vital, and I'm glad that FIFA are looking at that because I think that is important.
And even when they made a really good decision on the field of play, there was still that ridiculous moment a minute later when the ball went out for a throw-in where the ref had his finger to his ear while they were checking a correct decision. Almost just, why not just check that quietly, not let the ref get involved, not do this, the crowd booing at half-time. You know, I come from a place where I think this is here to stay, and I think that fundamentally it's good for the game and it will work, but they can't keep making these mistakes all the time, can they?
It's quite interesting. I was chatting to Jermaine earlier on, and I know he was at the game on Wednesday, and that is, you've got a situation that they talk about clear and obvious, they talk about missed serious on-field incidents, but what's been lost in the ether is they actually check goals. So that can rumble on. But as Jermaine said to me, you know, the referee on Wednesday, there was a situation. He was very clear in his own mind that it wasn't a penalty kick. And then we wait till the ball goes up the other end of the field to check it. And Jermaine was quite rightly saying that sometimes it might feel as though it's a sign of weakness. I think the training for the referees is really important in that respect, that they don't feel undermined and they have, you know, the courage to make the decisions like they do.
Well, we'll see what happens at the World Cup. Thank you, Chris. If the operators get it right, is there place in our game for VAR, or do you not want to see
it? Yeah, no, I think there is. I'm all for it, but I think it has to be perfect before it comes in. I don't think we're ready for it, and I think we're taking steps forward and then two steps back, and that's where all the confusion in and the different opinions are.
We talked about nightmare away trips last week, and it got us thinking about your Lasagna Gate experience. What's your memories of that game? apart from the food that didn't taste
good. Yeah, well, pretty, obviously.
Were you affected by it?
No, I wasn't. But I would, I think I had a stress fracture in my shin or something. But I was away with the team in the hotel. Yeah. I just wasn't affected by it. So we all travelled together, woke up to kind of text messages of us trying to get the game cancelled, ringing around the lads. Everyone's basically throwing up all over the place. Literally, I mean, the whole team.
Yeah.
Michael Carrick, I mean, I don't know how he went out and played a game of football.
Really?
I've never seen anyone really in a worse state than I saw Carra on that day, to the point where I think even during the game, Martin Yeo, he went to take Edgar Davids off because Edgar was having a nightmare and Edgar didn't actually have food poisoning.
Just playing like he had food poisoning.
He was just having a nightmare and Carra's come running over and gone, listen, you can't, I've got to come off. And he just ran off. Just run off the pitch and run straight down the tunnel. But obviously, I mean, we get beat and obviously West Ham are playing music.
And what was the situation in terms of the result you needed in that game?
We needed to equal, basically, Arsenal's result. So we just needed to win.
Qualify.
We needed to win to qualify for the Champions League. Didn't go our way. West Ham had some celebrations, but then Stevie cheered me up that summer when he smashed that one in the bottom corner.
There you go. There you go.
All winners.
When you've had things like
that. Footballers are bitter about the team.
Footballers are bitter. You're not bitter, are you?
Let's move on.
Do you have actually, I don't know if you want to go here or not, but do you have any bitterness about your career when you think that when you were coming through and Lampard and Steven were coming through at the same time and it was like, which of these guys, genius, or who's going to be the sort of England star? And then injuries and various bits and pieces just get in the way of that progress and you sit now and reflect on it and you know, 21 England caps rather than 121 England caps.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not bitter about it. I do live with some regrets. I didn't achieve what I set out to achieve in the game, which, you know, never sits well with you as a professional, I suppose. There were issues I had to deal with regards to, you know, injuries and so on. I also ran into probably one of the most elite midfield generations of probably, you know, one of, you know, of English history, when it comes to, you know, who I was competing with also. But a lot of that, you know, I stare kind of in the mirror and I look at myself and, it's things I have to take on about what I didn't bring to the table. There are other attributes, you know, kind of when I look at, say, Lamps, when he started to kind of really kick on. I remember a game in South Africa, I don't know if you played in that one, in Lucas Radebe's testimonial. And I'd kind of just come through as like the 19-year-old and, you know, Sven really liked me and it was, and Lamps had kind of got himself back into the equation and we were battling it out at this point. But, you know, Lamps had, he had Jose Mourinho at the helm, was pushing for Champions League and, you know, and I was at Newcastle where Bobby had just left and it was going the other way. But what it always boils down to, Jake, is yourself, you know, as a player. And, you know, there were moments during my career where I obviously just didn't do enough to kind of get to the
Why is that? Is it
needed.
The people that are around you or was it...
I think it definitely helps if you're playing in a Champions League side, though, and you're shining on a midweek under the lights. Like Frank, if he's playing for Chelsea, if he's Barcelona and he nicks a goal, he's bound to have an advantage when it comes down to England's selection over Jermaine if he's playing at Newcastle, with all due respect. So... Yeah. I think sometimes it depends on what players are around you, what club you're at, and what stage you're performing at, really.
I felt that a lot kind of when I was with England. When I was England, you could feel kind of the winners, I suppose, in the dressing room. We never performed really well as a team, I never found. There were too many individuals, really, and not enough kind of us together. But I always kind of felt like when I came back from England, my levels kind of went up, you know, and then I could almost feel them dwindle as kind of the weeks went on. So, like, training with England was at such an intense level and everyone wants to be in the team. And I'd come back to Newcastle and I'd be up here, miles ahead of everybody. And then literally, because the demand wasn't as high at Newcastle as it was with England, my standards just dropped and dropped and dropped gradually throughout the week to the point where you kind of bring yourself down back to Newcastle level, whereas Steve would be like Liverpool, Frank would be like Chelsea, Rio United, you know, and that's just how they were winners and they won things. Whereas I suppose that's the difference in the league. Mm. It's as simple as that. You know, some people accept kind of their space of where they're in. And whoever's in that dressing room, it's up to them, I suppose, to kind of drag everyone together and make sure you do go and achieve more. But
I think it's hard at that level as well. If you're not being successful or you're in a team that is, you know, an average performing team, it's hard to shine and drag them forward all the time. Mm. So if you're playing with England and you're training with them, and, you know, when you have the ball, Stevens bombing on or the right-back's bombing on, then suddenly you go back to Newcastle and you're expecting that right-back to be there and the right-back is not feeling confident today and is staying there. Sure, sure. And you're doing that side pass. you know, you want to be creative. You want people to do that, to give you the options. But if you're in a team that is, you know, is not firing or not flying every week, you're bound to have players who go, well, I'm staying here today, do you mean? And you're just passing there. And then you're the one who has to go and do things. So it's definitely the players around you can certainly lift you to another level. And on the flip side, can probably drag you back a lot.
But do you look at it and think, well, it was the midfield generation and I wasn't at a club that was pushing for the Champions League and I had a one day Ramos rather than Sir Alex Ferguson or Rafa Benitez as my manager? Or do you look at it and just think, I just wish someone had told me this career is over like that and just to knuckle down, because who knows what I could have done?
I don't blame anybody, no. You know, for what happened. I look at myself and, like I said, I've always been accepting of the way that it went to an extent. There are, you know, I do live with regrets because I didn't, again, like I said, set out achieve what I wanted to achieve in the game. But you know, you can talk about as many people as you want, Jake. You know, when I really kind of like do break it down, yes, you kind of say things like, I don't know, if I was here at Liverpool with Rafa Benitez, you know, because Steve has mentioned, you know, some of the teams here that he played in, you know, they weren't amazing teams.
Yeah.
But they're at Liverpool Football Club, a winning club. They had a manager that kind of knew how to win. And then you kick on from that. I probably didn't have that. But the bottom line of everything when it comes to being a football player is you look at yourself and somewhere along the line, I didn't do enough.
You were renowned for leading teams and banging your chest and being a great Liverpool captain. If you'd been at Leicester rather than Liverpool or Southend or Norwich or anywhere else, do you think you would have been the type of... the type of player.
Couldn't resist it, could you? Norwich.
Just a dream.
Southend, yes. Norwich.
Just imagine Stephen Gerrard at Norwich. That's what it was.
No, you can't help yourself.
I can't help myself. Have we mentioned Norwich enough today? Our game was postponed against Barnsley.
The answer to your question is no. Probably not.
You don't think you would have been the same player?
No, because I think I had top players around me, I had top managers, great environment to learn, i.e. Melwood, the academy, and coaches that have helped me grow and evolve as a player, so probably not. And I think being a local lad as well and sort of feeling that connection with the fans certainly helped me, especially here at Anfield, to raise and find consistency in my game.
But somebody must have sort of put that fight into you as a player, that self-belief, the drive, the desire.
I'm not sure you can put fight into someone. I think you've either got it or you haven't. Yeah. I think, you know, you've either got a heart and you've got that desire inside you and that's the way you play. I don't think you can sort of put that into someone. I think it's
at 16, 17, 18, when he was breaking into the team, before he reached the heights that he did reach and before he was as successful as he was, that hunger and desire was there at the training grounds. When he would join sort of myself in the bigger group at the time, when he was only 16, 17, the desire when he came across and joined in, with better players at him at the time, who'd achieved more than him at the time because he was only a baby learning straight, his desire and the hunger.
You remember
was
it, all, do you?
Yeah, it was always there. You never come over and thought, oh, is one of the kids, we'll have an easy day again. You know, we'll have an easy day against them. He was flying into tackles. He was aggressive. He was working hard. He was trying to learn. He was trying things out where he could fail, and he knows that, you know, no one will put any pressure on him. So the desire and hunger was always there. But with him in particular, because we're talking about him.
I don't think you can turn that on.
I don't think you can
sort of decide, oh, today we're playing West Brom, I'm just going to do that. I just think you turn up and you do it every single day. Every time there's a ball there, there's a game, there's a situation, you give it your all and your maximum. We were talking earlier about we're running more, we're making more tackles, blah, blah. Surely that's just a gimme, no? That's the minimum. Their values and principles as a footballer you should take onto any football pitch you walk on.
What did you think about Jermaine's comment about the regularity of playing in winning teams before you go?
I agree with him, and I think he's not the only case. I think a lot of players I've suffered over the years in terms of cap return and getting selected in 11s has gone against them. When you're coming up against teams like United, Chelsea, Tottenham, Arsenal, Liverpool players, because the expectation here was to win every single game. You never get a day off. With all due respect to certain clubs, if you lose a game or you're a little bit inconsistent, the fans and the clubs just go with it because they accept what type of club they are. I think playing here for Liverpool, the demand and the expectation helped me to get more England caps and to get picked and selected. And I think I had an advantage over Jermaine because I played for Liverpool and because I was in the Champions League. He had stages in his career where he was playing better than me. and his form was probably better, and maybe he should have been in the 11 before me at certain times. But I think being here at Liverpool, and he was probably at Newcastle or Tottenham at the time when he wasn't in the Champions League, I probably had an advantage because of the stage I was playing at. Yeah.
I think if you play with better players, they will always drag you to be better. And if you don't improve with those players, you'll be out.
Yeah.
And I remember training with John Barnes, Ronnie Whelan, the greats of Liverpool, who had won the league and the European Cup and the FA Cup, and they were winning everything. And as a 16-year-old, going and training with them and being involved with them, they would drag you to be a better player. And you train with them for a week, and if they didn't see anything out, it's very hard to get back in. So you had to keep on improving and improving and improving. So if he would have played with, and no disrespect to the players he's played with, not at all, we're just talking about his story, but if he would have played at Champions League level all the time, and he stayed fit, of course, because he had injury problems, he would have been, you know, on a much higher plateau than we're talking at this moment in time. Because the better players will have always pulled him forward and got every bit of what he can give in that team.
And you felt that when you were with England, as you say, you went back to your club and you felt a better player for it. So if there had been, if that move had come off for you, and I don't know how close you came to a United, a Liverpool, a Chelsea, an Arsenal, you know, if that had happened, that maybe would have made the difference.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was close at times. It was training with England that more had that impact. Kind of the games with England were frustrating at times, I found. You know, I was just talking to Maka before about kind of a specific situation where, you know, when you're at top clubs, as Stevie was saying, and you're part of a winning team, I felt that England managers just always lent towards that for safety reasons almost, rather than taking that risk, really. I remember there was a number of occasions where me and Michael Carrick, playing together at Tottenham, playing well, would sit on the bench, and, you know, Alan Smith, who's a centre-forward for United, but obviously he was hard-tackling centre-forwards, Sven were playing him in midfield. And me and him were looking at each other, or he'd play Ledley King in midfield, and we're going... Mm. What do we have to do here for you to, you know, to play me, you know, to put me in this situation? And I suppose, again, you might then start to lose faith within your, you know, yourself. You start to think, well, I'm not going to get a game. And that's you then switching off. That's not you kind of pushing and driving, which is part of...
That's where you've got to have a manager, though, who's strong enough to pick the best players for the team rather than the individuals and have the courage. I think Gareth has to sort of play the players that are in form.
Traditionally, though, it has felt like some England managers have picked on fame rather than form. 100%. If you're playing at Man United, you're going 100%. To get a game.
And also put players in the wrong position in big games.
To fit players in sometimes.
Don't want to say, well, I don't care who you are, but you're on the bench because you don't fit into the game plan today. Yeah.
If you could turn back the time to a 16-year-old Jermaine Genius, what's the one bit of advice you'd probably want to give?
Join Liverpool.
Join Norwich.
Did he say Norwich?
When I was at Forest and I had opportunities to kind of go to a couple of clubs, you know, Liverpool was one of those clubs, and United was one of those clubs, but it was very much, you know, it's an honour to play for those two clubs and you might get your opportunity. Whereas Bobby Robson went, you're playing now.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to play football. So I was like, I'm coming because I want to play in the Premier League right
Newcastle
now.
Are a huge team, aren't they? And at that time they were, so we have to reiterate that.
Thanks for listening to the Premier League Tonight podcast. Join us next week at the home of the champions, Chelsea, when they entertain Crystal Palace live on BT Sport 1 from 5 o'clock.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, where are you, the police?
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.